So we'll begin with a prayer to the Holy Spirit. O Holy Spirit, beloved of my soul, I adore you. Enlighten me, guide me, strengthen me, console me. Tell me what I should do. Give me your orders. I promise to submit myself to you that you desire of me and to accept all that you permit to happen to me. Let me only know your will. So I realize many of you I've known for quite a while, but some of you I've yet to meet. So my name is Father Richard Clancy. I'm a priest of the Archdiocese of Boston. I was ordained in June of 1991. And my first assignment was in a parish in the inner city of Boston. And then I went into campus ministry at Emmanuel College in UMass Boston. And right now I'm the director of campus ministry for the Archdiocese of Boston. So I don't know how many times this is I've been here. Probably at least five, maybe six. We'll figure that out before the end of the weekend. And as I was praying about, you know, what we were going to do, and I mean, we've done so many things, at least with pieces of you, your group. You know, we've done family life, the Blessed Mother, prayer life, the Eucharist. You know, as I went through so many things, and I really was praying, and what I try to do is really share with you some of the things that I'm working on myself and praying about and observing and thinking about. So that's where this topic came from. Living an intentional, gentle, Christ-centered life. Each one of those words is important. Intentional is really what we'll be talking a lot about tonight. Someone once said, and I think about it, and some of you have probably heard me say it before, this thought: how do you spell love? Now, you know, if I was with second graders, it'd all jump out, you know, L-O-V-E. That's true. But we also spell it T-I-M-E. Time. Because if we really think about it, we have time for the people that we love and for the things that we love to do. And we often will say or hear people say, I don't have time for that. Think about the time that it takes to golf 18 holes. I'm not a golfer. That's a lot of time. People find time to do that in very busy lives. Think about the way that you and I spend our time. What is it that we're saying by how we spend our time, what our priorities are, what we and who we love? The first of the year is a time when a lot of resolutions are made. You know, and I'm a believer in resolutions. Some of them really stick. You can make a resolution and you can make it stick. But many of our resolutions are in the wastebasket by January 2nd. Because you see, we have to distinguish between kind of a wish, a dream, or a program. So we can have a wish. Oh, you know, I wish I was like this, you know. I wish I read more. Well, where's the book? You know, or we can often dream. Our minds will be kind of somewhere else. And, oh, I would do this. If I had more time, I would do this. How often do we hear that? Or hear ourselves either say that or think it. How do we spend our time? And oftentimes people will say, I don't have time to do that. And what, at another level, they're saying is, it's not that important. Because if it was important, they would find or make the time. When people come and they say, you know, they want spiritual direction or they want some kind of suggestion or help, I will often advise them to just keep track of what they do every day. What are you doing? Don't change it now because you're writing it down. Write it down. See how you're spending your time, and see if how you're spending your time corresponds to what your priorities are. So most of us have this idea, well, the most important things in my life are my faith, my family, and my friends. Have we heard that before? You know, it's amazing, if you really think about it, how little time virtually all of us give to God. I work with a lot of college students and young people, so I try to make things simple. I'm a very simple person anyway, so it doesn't require much effort on my part. But now I think about it in terms of 24 hours. 24 hours. So no matter if you're young or you're old, you're rich or you're poor, whatever the circumstances in your life, if we're alive, we have 24 hours in every day. But now, even that sounds like a kind of a big number. So I break that into 10-minute periods. So did you ever, and I hope you're not kind of as bad off as me to actually have these kinds of thoughts, but if you were to break 24 hours into 10-minute periods, there's 144 10-minute periods in the course of a day. So what I would say to the young people is, do you think, as busy as you are, that you could find one out of 144 periods to give to God, to give to prayer? One 10-minute period. And actually, for those that have begun, two. Two out of 144. I mean, if you had 144 M&Ms and I asked you for two, you'd probably give them to me. You know, because, and you think about all the time that we have. All the time that we have. And how difficult it is for people to, quote, find time for God. So, when we break it down into periods, what is God asking for most people? I'm not talking about religious, I'm not talking about, you know, third order groups, or maybe not even you. But the average person out there, he might be asking for one out of 144, or two, maybe 10 or 20 minutes a day in prayer. And then 1 hour out of 168 hours a week. I did that math too. There's 168 hours in a week, and to come to Sunday Mass, to participate in Sunday Mass. One out of 168. It's amazing what a challenge that is for so many people in the lives that they live to, quote, find time to do this. So this is part of what we have to consider. This great gift of time, this great gift of today that we have. The way that we in our culture usually express value for things is with money or time. The things that people value are reflected in how they spend their money, how they commit their money, and how they spend their time. Merton had an interesting kind of expression about this presence to God in prayer. And he, you know, with quotes around it, he talked about wasting time with God. Just setting time apart in our very busy lives to just be with God, to be present to God. A lot of times for me, it's in my car. You know, as I tell the students, the car works without the radio on. You know, when you teach, some of you have had the experience of teaching teenagers to drive. Before they know how to do anything, they know how to do two things. Fix the mirror so that they can look at themselves and turn the radio. You see, God forbid we have a minute that we're not being bombarded with sound, with some kind of stimulus, with some kind of external thing happening. I mean, even in your car, any quiet moment, you can open yourself up to be present to God. And that gift of time that we give, that's what, you know, when we open ourselves and we spend that time, and the more time that we spend with God, the more time we want to spend with God. And the more that we see and other things are put into proper perspective of what's really important. Think about, for example, the amount of time that is spent watching television. Now, I must confess, now I can say I don't watch much TV, and that's true. I do watch too much sports on TV, I'll admit that. But when I think of some of the ridiculous things that are on the television, imagine this, you know, these shows that, you know, Joe Average, you know, whatever it is, this, you know, The Bachelor, The Bachelorette, Survivor, whatever the thing is, you know. Imagine if everybody who gave an hour to that did something productive in that time. The millions of people that are sitting there looking at this foolishness, who don't have time to do all kinds of important things, if they shut that TV off and went and visited somebody in a nursing home or went to a Eucharistic chapel and sat in front of the Blessed Sacrament or did some spiritual reading or just about anything, take a nap, would be more productive. You know, cleaning the hair out of your toothbrush, I mean, you know, would be more productive than that. You know, see, most people, truthfully, and this is why I say you write down, because most people, truthfully, spend hours a week in front of a television set that is not productive time. And then they find they don't have time to do things that, well, you know, then it has to be adjusted, has to be changed. Time is an investment. We invest time in the things that are important. It's so beautiful to see somebody play a musical instrument. And as I watch them play that musical instrument, I often think of all of the hours that were invested and are invested in learning that, in practicing that, in honing that gift, that skill. That time could have been spent watching Survivor or some other. See, what's important? What do we find time for? How do we carve this out? We live in a microwave world. Instant results. We need everything right now. It's funny, I was talking just outside. You know, you hear that expression, that's the best invention since sliced bread. Well, see, to me, that makes no sense. I mean, how do you compare sliced bread that you buy in the store to real bread? But real bread takes time. And, you know, you got to get it, and you got to knead it, and you got to put it out there, and you got to watch it rise, and you got to do all the, you know. Well, you can go and buy that, you know, that cardboard bread down at the store, you know, ultra-light bread that you bite into, and it's like nothing. And you say, this is bread? Then you have a real piece of bread. Aha, you see? But we're always looking for the shortcut. Whether it's, you know, like down here, you have iced tea. You know, when we have iced tea, You open up these jars and you put a spoon in or something and you put it in water and you stir. Well, let me tell you, that's not iced tea. That's, you know what iced tea is down here. You know, you really brew it. You really do it. You really do it. You know, you remember that Tang stuff? It's the most awful tasting stuff in the world. But, you know, how do you compare that to a fresh squeezed? When you have, you know, real homemade pizza, as opposed to some of this real cardboard pizza that you buy at, you know, some of these places. You see, good things, quality things, take time. Real time, a real investment, not just in time, but in energy, in presence, in commitment. So much is communicated by somebody serving homemade bread. You know, when you go to somebody's house and like they've baked everything, you know, when I go to somebody's house and they made the homemade pasta, well, then that's worth a second helping. I mean, I can justify that. But you know what? It communicates something, that this is of value, that this time that we have together is of value, that what we share is important. This is true in vocational life, raising children. You know, my mother told me that raising children is a full-time job for part of your life. That's true. When you think about it, those of you who have young children are probably saying, yeah, right, you know. But the fact is they grow. They require so much of your time and energy and love and presence and for a short time. Then they turn into teenagers and they don't require anything from you. Leave me alone. They're not even sure they want you around. But you see that this is so important, and the time that we spend with young children is so critically important for their formation, time that will never come back. Time, they're not going to go back to being 3 years old again. So that the time that we invest when they need that time is so important. What does the world have to say about this? You know, I wish I had a nickel for every time I heard someone say, I want to give my children what I didn't have. And you know, I just want to say, oh, you poor baby. What didn't you have? Now, I'm not talking about bad situations, okay? I mean, we know that there have been bad situations and sad and difficult and abusive situations. I'm not talking about that. I'm talking about, like, people that actually had to share a bedroom with their brother or sister. You know, oh, you know, what a tragedy that is. You know, I want to give my children what I didn't have. The next question would be, would that be at the expense of what you did have? So maybe your kid can have a car when they're 16. Maybe they can have opportunities and money and computers and all these kinds of things. But you know, I've worked with young people. I work with young people. You know the two things that I find children want? To know that they're wanted and that they're loved. The kids don't care how big their house is. They want to be with their mommy and daddy. That's what's important. That's what's priority. And I think that we become kind of secularized by all that's around us, by all the pressures around us, that what we think that what matters is our careers. You know, it's an interesting thing. I look at career as a past tense word. And after you're at something for about 25 years, I guess you can say, I have a career in such and such. But, you know, I mean, my father had a job. My father was a very smart man. He was a valedictorian of his class. He was the first one in his family to ever go to college. He had a full scholarship offer to Harvard. He didn't go there. He liked Tufts better. It had smaller classes. He got his degree in chemistry, and he went and got a job. And I'm sure he could have, quote, done better, but he loved to be with his family, and he wanted to be home every night for dinner. That's what was important to him. And I don't think he ever regretted that. I think that was what he wanted to do. And see, all around us now, it becomes more and more difficult to do that because what matters and what's rewarded and what's lifted up is, you know, we have all these mick houses where everybody has their own bathroom, they have their own bedroom, they have their own, you know, study. You go into some of these places and the master bedroom is as big as this room we're in, you know? And you say, well, when do you ever have time to be in here anyway? With the three jobs you're working? You know, we have a materialistic, consumer-driven culture. We have the pressure. You, as lay people, You have the pressure, and I don't, you know, I'm not, it's real to have it all, to do it all, to be it all. And you know what happens is we find ourselves living the life that we feel expected by others to live, and then we just try to ignore that ache of emptiness that's within us. We should be happy. I mean, we have all this stuff. What's missing? It's curious, you know, we've invented this concept of quality time. Quality time. We have all kinds of interesting concepts, don't we? Quality time. You know what that says to me? If I say to you, I'm going to spend quality time with you, what it means to me is, I won't be around much. But I'm going to try to be around at what seems to be important. You know, some people, that they talk about the weekend warrior. You know, they're never around, and then they just follow their kid around from the soccer field to the ballet lessons to the thing on Saturday, and then, you know, I'm a super father because, you know, I do all this stuff with my kids. There's no substitute for quantity of time. Quality time. See, the problem with that is we never know when the significant moment is going to happen. So yeah, I can go to your graduation, I can go to your confirmation, I can go to the night that you have the lead role in the play, but that doesn't substitute for the quantity of presence, of love, that is shared every day. I had a friend who, for a while after she got out of college and graduate school, she was a producer for the Oprah show. And now she works in New York as a public relations person. You know, it's one of those people that you don't know what they do. They just have a kind of an important job somewhere. But I remember her telling me this story, and she's a very, very sweet person. She said, you know, that there was this woman, this young woman, who was dying of cancer, and she had a daughter. And she said, I want to experience with my daughter everything that we would have experienced if my life was a little longer, so that my daughter can remember having these memories with me. They did everything. You know, they did all the stuff that everybody does. They went to Disneyland, they went to France, they went here. They just went on this whirlwind tour trying to squeeze everything in. And it was a beautiful experience, and they had camera crews following them. They had all these pictures. They had this beautiful kind of thing. And, you know, the woman did die, and time went by, and they brought in the, say, 12 or 13-year-old girl into the show. And so they said to her, they showed this clip of her doing all these things, you know, riding the roller coaster and doing all this stuff and, you know, eating at the, you know, the places and going to shopping in New York City and all this. And they said to her, Oprah, I guess, said to her, what is your favorite memory that you had with your mom? And the girl said, well, it was none of those things. She said, one night I was kind of scared, and I woke up, and I went, and I woke up my mother, and we went downstairs in the kitchen at about 3 o'clock in the morning, and we ate Cheerios together and laughed. That was the moment. That was the moment that she treasured. And if you think back on your own life, isn't it true that the memories that you have of people are not often the dramatic moments, but the simple, everyday, beautiful moments in life that you shared? When I do a funeral homily, I certainly don't want to canonize the person that I'm, you know, that we're praying for. But I also like to incorporate at least something about the person, something about what they valued or what was important or what they, you know. And so if I didn't know the person, I'll try to find out from other people, you know, what was this person like? And of course, you'll hear all kinds of people that will read you almost, well, they were the president of the Lions Club, and they were this, and they were that, and then you say, thank you, because that's not the person you want to talk to. Then you talk to, you know, they go on and on listing achievements, and then you go to the person and they say, you know what was weird about them is they used to actually put ketchup on their bologna sandwiches. Then you say, aha, here's a person who knew the person. You know, you spend time with people, you share life with people, and you come to understand what it is. And to be aware of what's around us, you know, people are so rude. Sometimes you'll say hello to a person behind a counter and they almost pass out. Or they want to, you know, close the register fast, you know, like, what's this guy up to? What does he want? You know, people are just so rude, in a hurry, pushing, pulling, struggling, life on the run. You know, I have the image, so many people, they're like that hamster on a treadmill, just waiting for the next bar to take another slap at it, you know? There's no reflection on what they're doing, they're just in a hurry. They don't mean to be rude, but they don't have time. And you contrast that with Jesus. When I think about the life of Jesus, when you read Scripture, a lot of times the thing that comes to my mind is he was always being interrupted. I often think in my own life, I don't know whether I wake up and I'm quiet and I'm going about my business and I don't know whether I'm in a good mood or a bad mood. I don't know anything until that phone rings. And sometimes that phone rings and you're ready to just take it and throw it out the window. You say, aha, I think I'm in a bad mood today. Maybe I need to visit that chapel for a few minutes before I go out and inflict this on others. But, you know, some of that's our humanness, you know. We're not, everything isn't sweetness and light all the time. But, you know, when you think about Jesus, most of the encounters we read about in Scripture were he was on his way somewhere. He was moving through this crowd. He was walking down this street. He was going to see so-and-so. And people interrupted him. They came at him. And he was totally present to them. He had all the time in the world for them. He was available to that person in front of him. How much that should teach us who are disciples of Jesus, how to be with people. None of us are perfect, but yet to have that idea that any moment could be a significant encounter. I think about people, you know, I mean, of course, I take it sometimes to ridiculous degrees, but, you know, coming down here, I had two beautiful conversations with people that I rode down on the plane with. People that I was actually able to meet and to talk to and to share a little bit of life with. What a gift people are to us that we encounter in our day. Someone once said, and you know, it's one of those things, I don't know, it's more like just a common expression as opposed to some necessarily high spiritual truth, but I think it's true. They said that character is revealed by how we treat people who can do nothing for us. Think about that. You know, the worst people that I, in my experience, the worst people to work under are people who are falling all over the boss because they don't care about you. You can't do anything for them. So if you're under that person, look out. When you think about the people that you really admire and respect as people, they're people that treat people with respect, whether they be of high, you know, social status or low. One of the things that gives me great pleasure is when I walk into one of those millions of Dunkin' Donuts in Boston, the people behind the counter smile because I've learned three words in Portuguese that I can say to them. And they, oh, father, father. You know, how many people just throw their money at them and treat them like human garbage? You see? To be able to just say hello, to learn their names, to find out how are your children, you know, to engage a person in a human encounter. This is Christ-like. They're important people. Who are we to decide who's important and who isn't? Because to Jesus, everybody's important. I gave a talk at one of the graduations to the students, and I developed that theme, that And I told them many times, and they quoted back to me. So when people start quoting something back to you, that makes you feel good, even if they do it to kind of tease you. Because I would always say to them, there's no such thing as an unimportant person, and there's no such thing as an ordinary day. Because I believe that when we stand before the mercy, judgment, whatever you want to call it, seat of Christ, we're going to have to give an account of how we treated seemingly unimportant people on apparently ordinary days. And I know in my life that the greatest blessings that have come to me have often been unanticipated. My truest friends have been people that I never planned on meeting. God was working. And to the extent that we are open to those kinds of graces that we can meet with the people, we meet Christ in them, they meet Christ in us. We share life, even if only for a minute. They can know that they matter, that they're loved, that they're respected. I used to, at Emmanuel, I had a special kind of tender place for the international students. They used to call themselves, and we used to call ourselves, the little UN. We often ate lunch together. Sometimes this guy from Turkey would come, and then we'd have a few women from the Philippines and this Pakistani Muslim from, you know, of course, Pakistan. And I remember when I left Emmanuel and I had the mass, they all came and they all got dressed up in all their native, you know, and they sat right up front and all that. But I remember one day we had a conversation at lunch, and she had told me, she said, I walked by the Pakistani Muslim girl, she said, I walked by that room you were giving your presentation in, and she said, I saw there were only two students there. And I said, yes, you know, of course, that was par for the course, you know. And I said to her, I said, you know, that must seem kind of pathetic to you. I must seem kind of pathetic to you. And they all at the table got very quiet and very sad. And this girl, this Pakistani Muslim girl, said to me, Father, you're not pathetic. She said, that's why we love you, because you treat every one of us like we're the most important person in the world. And I was just like, what? But this is what was being communicated to her. And when she graduated and her whole family came, the person she wanted them to meet was me. Now, I don't say that to say, oh, what a wonderful guy I am. But what I'm saying is that we shared not our faith in a God, yes, but we shared moments in life that were special, that made her feel that she mattered in this foreign country with people of other faith. You see, we never know when our efforts, when our work, when our love is going to bear fruit, and God has no obligation to tell us. You know, when an important play comes on, you know, in football, sometimes the people that control the sound effects will, you know, it's third and one or fourth and one, and they'll make a gong sound. This is important, you know. But the fact of the matter is we never know in the course of a game when the important play is. And the truth of it is, in the course of your life, you never know when a very significant day, when you wake up on a specific day, you don't know that this is going to be the day. I did a wedding a few years ago. Several years ago now, and these people had met, they had lived only a few blocks apart their whole life, and had never met because they were both shy, and the girl went to the girls' Catholic schools, and the boy went to the boys' Catholic schools, and, you know, never the twain shall meet. And it snowed one day, and they both decided to take the bus, and they met at the bus stop. Now, my guess is when they woke up and they looked and they saw the snow outside, they didn't probably say, oh, it's beautiful, it's snowing. They probably thought other thoughts. But then I remember it because it was right before my father died 8 years ago. And I went and I I was not leaving my house on my father's side for any reason, but I went and I did that wedding because they were a special couple. And God's grace brought them together, and they realized how blessed they were to have been brought together and meet each other on that seemingly ordinary day. Don't look at your life in a passive way. One of the hard things is to hear people talk about their life as if they were watching a movie projected on a screen. They'll tell you, well, then this happened, and then that happened, and then this happened, and then that happened. And you say, well, where were you? You know, didn't you make any choices? You're where you are, and I'm where I am because we made choices. And if we want our life to get better, if we want our life to become more gentle, more Christ-centered, more balanced, more happy, more holy, we're going to have to make choices to make that possible. So what we have to do is be intentional. Make it happen. Seize the moment. Pray for the grace. Pray specifically for graces that you need in order to live this life. Take charge of your own life. Set goals. One of the things that, you know, you read in these kind of books, and you know, but I think sometimes there's true advice in them, to write down some goals. Take out a pen and a paper and write down, this is what I want. This is what I'm going to do. You can hide it someplace so that, you know, somebody's not saying, you said you were going to, no. It's between you and you and you and God. But to say, this is what I want to do. And I think specifically to set goals for ourselves time-wise. All right, I'm going to pray 15 minutes a day. And I'm going to, but you can't just say that. I'm going to pray from 6:45 a.m. to 7 a.m. every day. See, now that becomes real. Now you have some measure of what you're going to do. And to set goals spiritually, physically, and intellectually. To try to take good care of ourselves. To try to make sure that we get the proper sleep. I think that's so important. I think virtually all of us are sleep deprived because, see, there's only so much time. So, of course, then we walk around like zombies because we've tried to squeeze it all in. No, we need rest. We need proper rest, proper care of, you know, trying to watch and eat more healthily. Try to work in some time of physical, not even necessarily, you know, many of you are not at the age and stage in your life where you're going to go run the marathon. But to do some exercise, to do some walking. I often combine at least part of my prayer and my exercise, you see, to say that, okay, while I'm exercising, I can be praying. Now, that doesn't substitute for the time that I just pray, but why not? Why not pray while you're cooking? Why not pray while you're driving? Why not pray while you're doing these tasks? So that it becomes part of your life. To set a goal intellectually. Now, that doesn't mean go out and, you know, get 4 or 5 degrees. Do some reading. What are you reading? What are you reading right now? What book do you have going? Are you reading scripture? Are you doing some spiritual reading? Keep that going. Keep it going. Keep nurturing yourself. Keep feeding yourself spiritually. And like I say, be specific. Remember this. To choose is to lose. Now, you know, I do that a lot with vocational kind of discussion with students and young people. When we choose, we lose. You know, when Yogi Berra once said, when you come to the fork in the road, take it. Well, you know. And that's where a lot of people find themselves, right there. Because you see, if I move in this direction, I can't move in that one. So as soon as I choose, if I choose to spend time doing this, I'm going to lose the possibility of doing other things. So to understand that, to say, I choose to spend more time with my family, so I lose, you know, whatever. Shopping time, that second job, whatever it is. If I choose this, I lose this. Can I embrace or accept what I'm losing is important. Keep before your mind the very fragile nature of life. For some of us, it's of course a very, you know, we're still raw from losing a loved one very recently. I know that. Our lives are fragile. We're not going to live forever. So every day is a great gift. See, on the one hand, we can kind of buy into a very fatalistic point of view. Well, we're all going to die, so what difference does it make? Some days we feel that way, but we can't allow ourselves to feel that way. Someday I'm going to die, so I have today, and I'm going to live it. And I'm going to seize this moment, and I'm going to give as much of myself, as much as of my love, as much of my energy as I can to serve God. Someday, some rainy day, sit down and write out what you would want your eulogy to be. You might want a bottle of wine with you when you do it, and some sad music. But, you know, it's 10 years from now, it's 20 years from now, it's 40 years from now, whatever it is, that day will come for every one of us. And when I say that, I don't mean in terms of a self-aggrandizement kind of, oh, he was this, he was that, she was this, no. But at the end of your life, what's going to be there? What will you have invested your time in, your love in, your energy in? Start where you, that person that you want to be at the end of your life, and figure out, beginning right now, what I'm going to do to become that person cooperating with God's grace. Life is a journey. Life is a gift. Live every day. Engage every person. And like the Emmaus disciples, as we journey, we'll find Christ right in our midst. How often have we thought at the end of the day, at the end of an encounter with a person, were not our hearts burning within us as we encountered Christ in the love that we have for each other, in the love that we share around the Eucharist? St. Francis was asked, Francis, if today was the last day of your life, what would you do? At the time, he was weeding his little garden. And he leaned on his hoe a little bit, and he thought for a second. And he said, if today was the last day of my life, I'd finish weeding this garden. If today was the last day of my life, I'd be doing what I'm doing, you see. And to the extent that we can say that, then we're living that intentional life. And to the extent that we're not yet doing that, that we don't yet have the serenity, that we would do something totally different, then we have to say, why? Living an intentional, gentle, Christ-centered life. You can have the serenity of St. Francis. You can know the same peace. And it begins by spelling out love, T-I-M-E, to our God and to every person that we meet.